maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either-or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, or TeamSpace, or Calendar, or QuickNote, have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared. Hi everyone, it's Connor Boyle here. Before we get into this week's episode, there's something I'd love you to give a try. We've just launched a new online streaming platform, Intelligence Squared Plus. It's packed with over 20 years of our debates, and whether you want to tune in live and watch along and ask your questions, or watch back on demand, everything is totally ad-free and there's endless hours of discussion to dive into. The usual price is £14.99 a month, but we want to give you, our podcast listeners, a special offer to give it a try. For 10 days only, we're offering a subscription for only £10 a month, and the offer ends at midnight GMT on Tuesday, 20th December. Get it while you can. So if you want to join the Intelligence Squared Plus community, visit intelligencesquaredplus.com or click the link in the episode description to subscribe and use the discount code MONTH10 or ANNUAL10 to start watching today. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, President Zelensky has been the national symbol of Ukrainian resistance. Today on the podcast, we're joined by the authors of a new book profiling the leader and what they call the Zelensky Effect. When American forces suggested a potential evacuation of Volodymyr Zelensky from a beleaguered Ukraine at the beginning of the invasion, he famously declared, "I need ammunition, not a ride." But how did Zelensky, once an actor who played the president on television, come to be one of the most charismatic and significant wartime leaders of the 21st century? Olga Onuk and Henry Hale's new book tells that story, and here's our host for the episode, Carl Miller, research director at Demos, with more.
I'm joined by two wonderful authors and researchers. Firstly, we have Olga Onuk, a senior lecturer in politics at the University of Manchester and former fellow of the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, and Henry Hale, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and co-director of the program on new approaches to research and security in Eurasia. Together, they are the authors of this new book, The Zelensky Effect, which we're going to be talking about today. Olga, Henry, very, very warm welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
All right. So let's begin just with the Zelensky effect itself. So the kind of backbone argument of the book, what are you arguing that the effect of Zelensky is, and where has it come from?
So, Henry, why don't I take this one to start out with? Well, we like to talk about the Zelensky effect as two sides of the same coin. So on the one hand, in order to even begin to understand Zelensky, the wartime president, you really need to understand the nation that he is born out of. This incredible Ukrainian contemporary political community where ordinary citizens have a very strong attachment to the state and a sense of civic identity, where their belonging above everything is state-centric. And they also have this really impressive sense of democratic duty to the country. And this is embodied in Zelensky over time. This is something that he is nurtured in throughout the many moments of mass mobilization, and that helps him become the man we know today. On the flip side of the coin is the effect that Zelensky had on very particular portions of the Ukrainian population in rallying them to the state, specifically after he was elected to the presidency. He really often talked about this united Ukraine that is above everything united in its, again, civic duty and not in some ethno-linguistic divides that others may have talked about more frequently. And he does this repeatedly in all his speeches as first, or his skits, actually, first as an actor and comedian, then in his speeches as a president. And then later, of course, he rallies the nation when Russia invades Ukraine, not for the first, but for the second time on February 24th, 2022. Henry, maybe you want something to add there.
No, I think that was well stated.
Henry's shaking his head. So Henry, I'm going to go to you next. Now, Olga, thank you for that. So let's go, Henry, to Zelensky's birth. Where is he born? When is he born? And I think you've already mentioned that he's this kind of member of the independence generation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we developed the idea of what we call the independence generation as the generation of Ukrainians who were born in the late Soviet period. So Zelensky himself being prototypical in 1978, but going within that general age range. And those people who had their first real formative experiences in an independent Ukraine. So they might remember the Chernobyl accident, the nuclear power plant accident, and they would remember Ukrainian independence, but they really became adults and rose to prominence entirely in an independent Ukraine. And so we talk about Zelensky as a representative of this generation. And in particular, he was born in the city of Kryvyi Rih, which is not very well known to Western audiences, but is one of Ukraine's biggest cities. It's part of Ukraine's industrial heartland in the Dnipropetrovsk Oblast or region. And that more broadly is in Ukraine's southeast, which is historically predominantly Russian speaking, but also bilingual. And Zelensky rose up in this atmosphere. It was he describes his youth as a challenging one. It was a hard scrabble type of city with lots of organized crime, but at the same time, very well connected because it was, as I mentioned, the kind of industrial heartland of Ukraine, or at least part of it. And so he rose up in this general milieu. And he himself, of course, is of Jewish heritage. So both his parents are Jewish. And he himself grew up primarily speaking Russian. And then, but at the same time, one of the central arguments of the book is that he was still very much identified as a Ukrainian. And he himself identified with Ukraine as his country. And one of the big mistakes that analysts have made is thinking that, well, people who are not of Ukrainian ethnic heritage, who don't primarily speak Ukrainian as a language, aren't going to be strongly identified with Ukraine, aren't going to really want to fight for it, aren't going to be loyal to it. But in this way, he personifies that the opposite is true.
So, Olga, I mean, I'm jumping ahead a little. We're going to get back to the chronology in a second. But just dwelling just for a moment on Zelensky's origin, How important since the invasion has it been to have a president who is a Russian-speaking Ukrainian Jew from the southeast of Ukraine? Would it have been different had we seen a president that was from the West?
So, oddly enough, we haven't seen a president from the West, really, in Ukraine. That's a very long history of central Ukrainian, southern Ukrainian, and so on presidents. But here, I think it's really important to say that it's not so much that during the all-out war with Russia, that it's important that he is from the southeast and that he is a Russophone, that he identified as such for a very long time. But rather, it was already during his presidency. We say in the book that he was perhaps brave to just be very frank about his Russophone upbringing and demonstrate that it didn't mean that he was in any way less patriotic than other Ukrainians. Of course, the matter of language for some Ukrainians is very important. There is one state language in Ukraine. But nonetheless, he was embodying a civic patriotism of ethnic Russians, ethnic Jews, Hungarians, Russian speakers that made up a very large and significant minority of the country. And as Henry said, it is exactly this pre-wartime period that he was able to really start rallying the southeastern population that perhaps prior to 2019 really didn't see themselves as part of the in-group when it came to civic patriotism in the country. So by the time the war starts, he's already rallied this population. Right. And one of the things we mention actually in the book is that a very significant portion of Ukrainians come to support democracy as the best system for the country. In 2019, right before Zelensky is elected, it's at 41%. But by the time of February 2022, right before Russia is about to start its all-out invasion of Ukraine, that number was just around 60%. And what correlated most strongly with this jump was having voted for Zelensky's party, Sluha Narodu, and also significantly correlated being from the southeast of the country or being from key areas of the southeast. So he was rallying this population for quite some time. And undoubtedly, these individuals, these people were the first ones at the front lines stopping tanks with their bare hands.
Thank you, Olga. And so right, back to our chronology. So 1991, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union. How important was this for Zelensky? You know, how difficult was life in newly independent Ukraine for him? Henry, take us through those early. He would have been old enough to remember all of this, wouldn't he? He would have known about all this happening around him.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a time of, I think, mixed emotions for Ukrainians, because on one hand, there was tremendous excitement about Ukraine becoming independent, and there was a lot of opportunity involved. Young people like him who are ambitious suddenly had the possibility of rising to do whatever they wanted to do without having to go through the Communist Party, as had been in the case in the Soviet Union. And of course, they were now free from the bias against people who identified as anything other than Soviet or Russian in the Soviet period. So on one hand, it was a time of great opportunity and excitement about the independence of Ukraine and what that could bring. There was a lot of optimism that Ukraine might soon join the ranks of Europe and reach those levels of prosperity. But as we talk about in the book, reality proved to be much, much more difficult. The economy had been constructed by the Soviet regime to be intimately interdependent with the Soviet economy and with Russia's economy in particular. So you had the breakage of many of those ties. And the initial leadership of Ukraine seemed to want to focus much more on establishing Ukraine's international profile than on actually dealing with a lot of the problems that other people, that ordinary people faced. And that meant rampant inflation, crushing poverty, and immense inequality, because there are a few people, we write about them as the so-called oligarchs in Ukraine, who took advantage of the situation to become super rich and then used that initial money to consolidate their hold over Ukraine's economy and political system. So to bring it back down to somebody like Zelensky, he had a lot of talent. He was able to be educated in a free environment where he studied economics and law in college. He also had the opportunity to begin his entertainment career in a free environment, which was especially important for him given his proclivity towards satire and his interest in politics. And so it was at once very, very difficult. His parents were both professors, academics, and they, you know, that might sound very prestigious, but we talk about in the book how one of the things that the Soviet collapse brought was poverty, even for categories of people like that, who being not in business per se, were actually paid miserly salaries and had to get by doing all kinds of things. His father took stints working abroad in Mongolia. And so it was at once difficult, but once at the same time, a time of opportunity. But for the vast bulk of Ukrainians, I think it was a similar set of feelings. But the dominant feeling at the level of society and politics over the course of the 1990s, we write, was one of growing frustration and frustration with the poverty and corruption in the country, and the desire for something better.
Mm. And I think you touched on there, Henry, one of the things I took from the kind of shape of the way you narrate the following years, which are these kind of rising waves of optimism and then dashed hopes, and then again optimism, and then again disappointment. So Olga, take us into perhaps the first, or after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the second really, really key chapter there, the Orange Revolution. You know, what was people like Zelensky and others, what was he hoping for, and what did they find instead?
Well, right. I think it's important to say here that although Zelensky is one of, and quite frankly, a very famous representative of the independence generation, he was not actually one of those who was visible in the Orange Revolution protests, or no, to have been a supporter of them. So that's important to note. But the Orange Revolution is this incredible moment of mass mobilization, of people power, a reaction to this fraudulent election. And within hours of the official announcement of what is known to be widespread electoral fraud and manipulation, hundreds of thousands of people go out onto the streets of Kyiv and elsewhere to protest this. And of course, this election result is overturned, as we now know. The people won in this case. And you have this sense of euphoria, right? At least for about half of the population that was on the winning side. What you have immediately after, right, is this complete disenchantment with politics, because these revolutionary heroes, Viktor Yushchenko, who became president on the heels of the Orange Revolution, and his right-hand woman, Yulia Tymoshenko, who becomes prime minister, you see them fighting constantly over who holds what reins of power in the legislature, in government, and so on. And this becomes an incredibly unstable period of elite politics in the country. And you also see a decline in a lot of other indicators of well-being in Ukraine. So although you see an uptick in quality of democracy in Ukraine and general freedoms, in fact, Ukraine becomes a free democracy at this point, and then unfortunately goes back again, backslides again. You have this period that is just full of instability. And if you were in your 20s and you grew up throughout the turbulent 90s, you had this moment of intense euphoria and feeling of ordinary citizens' victory. And then you realize that politicians are just yet again fighting, not able to find any compromises, deciding to use identity politics that, again, only divide the population. And you also see that there isn't a place for you at the table yet, right? This independence generation is not only not welcomed into the halls of power, but also they are not able really to buy flats now. And if they are buying flats, they're buying flats in euros. And with, you know, the knowledge that the currency might completely collapse in the future and they won't be able to pay their bills. So this becomes yet again an unstable period for the independence generation and others just like Zelensky. Although for him, this is a moment when he becomes actually quite famous, returning to Ukraine and working for Odin plus Odin, one plus one, the at the time, the top television channel.
Well, Henry, let's bring you in here on this point around how satire was being connected up with those waves of disappointment. So tell us a bit about what Zelensky's doing at this point in his life, you know, like his burgeoning media career and kind of what he seems to be moving towards kind of creatively.
Yeah, so one of the things that he got involved with during his university years, what is known in Russian as KVN or KVN, which basically translates to the Club of the Funny and Quick-Witted. And this is basically a competition for of people who are improv performers, but it's not simply improv. Among the elements of the competition are responding wittily to pointed questions, and there's frequently political content. And he was very famous and successful in this, to the point that he regularly competed even in the Moscow circuit and actually at one point co-won one of the big championships there. And so he worked for 6 years in Russia, but then it was during the period that we're talking about that he moved back to Ukraine, and because he decided he didn't really like Moscow very much, found it unfriendly, and wanted to make his entertainment show business career there. And he rose up very quickly, started producing shows with a group of people who were the core of his Kvartal 95 troupe. Kvartal 95 basically means the 95th block, which is the name of his neighborhood where he grew up. And so and that itself indicates a perspective trying to connect with ordinary people. And that's a lot of what his initial satire was about, were the concerns of ordinary people and the indifference of politicians, among other things, as well as a whole bunch of just slapstick stuff that a lot of people found not funny, but that really widely connected with a lot of Ukrainians. And so he was so successful that he ultimately became the general producer for Ukraine's most popular television network at the time, Inter, and had this job during the presidency of Viktor Yanukovych, who was the villain in the Orange Revolution and one of the results of the disillusionment that I and Olya were talking about earlier, and Olya talking about after the Orange Revolution, is that Ukrainians freely elected Yanukovych back to the presidency in 2010, and he proceeded to take things in a strongly authoritarian direction. And this was a time when Zelensky himself was managing the programming of this major TV channel, including the news. And this was a time when the Yanukovych administration was issuing temniki or directives as to what television news should cover and how they should cover certain stories. And so one thing that this tells us is, first of all, that he was intimately involved and certainly aware of politics, because this was a heavily political job. It was also a major managerial job. He was effectively a media mogul. So later comments that, well, he was simply a comedian becoming president later doesn't take into account the fact that he had this political background and had this major managerial experience. And in the end, he wound up jumping ship from this channel to another channel, which is One Plus One. And that's the one that he continued to work with up until he became president. And so it was during this period that he really became very prominent, and his programming on his shows was highly political. And it's interesting. This was a time when there was a squeeze on a public criticism, when the regime was taking control of politics and squeezing out opposition. One of the main opposition figures, Yulia Tymoshenko, former prime minister, was actually jailed. But Zelensky and his shows, his concerts that he was organizing, were engaging in very sharp political satire that was often directed against Yanukovych and the regime.
Mm. All right. So from Yanukovych, we have obviously 2013 interfaunted Euromaidan, and then the appearance of yet another kind of a political insider, Poroshenko. So can you, Olga, maybe explain a bit about patronal politics and how it is that these figures, Timoshenko, Poroshenko, Yushchenko, how they keep appearing in high political office, despite, it seems, these kind of waves of popular unrest that really are calling for something quite different to emerge from Ukrainian politics?
Well, patronal politics is really Henry's thing, so I'll let him maybe come in here a little bit. But I think it's really important that to highlight what you just said, that there are individuals that are around in every single government, and that is, until now, Petro Poroshenko. This is an individual that had his own parties, that was one of the co-founders of the Party of Regions, that was then later Yanukovych's party. So he was intimately connected to Yanukovych and Party of Regions in that way. He was also in Yanukovych's government for a period of time. But he is really the consummate insider, right? And he is also from this earlier generation and just before the independence generation that really was able to make an incredible personal wealth for himself in the 90s, right? And his different businesses that we don't need to go into right now. But this is somebody that becomes a billionaire over time and is always near or holding the hands of power. So I think it's very interesting that, of course, he becomes the main opposition figure in the Euromaidan, the mass mobilization of 2013-14. It's interesting most because the Euromaidan is supposed to be not only about this Euro-Atlanticist direction that Ukraine's supposed to be going in towards, not only about dignity and, you know, human rights, because Yanukovych's regime was literally shooting at protesters, but it was also about dignity against this entrenched patronal oligarchic systemic corruption in the country, that these key figures not only control politics, but also the economy and become these barons of politics and economy in the country. So that makes Poroshenko a very odd figure that rises to become the main opponent to Yanukovych. And then, of course, the post-revolutionary or the revolutionary president.
Henry, jump in and quickly tell us about patronal politics. I mean, there's one detail that caught my eye in the book where I think is it candidates handing out caskets for votes, which is a detail I've never seen before in any description of political corruption. So what on earth is happening there? How is this all working?
Well, basically, patronal politics is a politics where people work through connections involving actual personal acquaintance to get whatever they need to get done. Not trusting or not relying on institutions, formal rules. And that was the key to the rise of these oligarch figures that we're talking about, these massive business people. And I mentioned earlier how they translated their money into control over politics. And the phenomenon you mentioned with caskets is one of the ways that they would do it, is they had a lot of money. How do you convert that to political power? Well, you can give gifts to voters or to whole towns or collectives or institutions and give them promises in all kinds of different ways. And, you know, funerals are very expensive. Caskets are expensive. So that could actually be a valuable gift in that context. So that was one of the problems. And that was one of the reasons why the same old figures kept finding ways to come back when they would have divisions among them at the top that would create opportunities for this mass mobilization to happen. But then they'd always find some way to sneak back in. So after the Orange Revolution, the new president, Viktor Yushchenko, had been the previous president's prime minister. Then when he was voted out and Yanukovych was elected, who had actually been the president before, he'd actually been one of Yushchenko's successors as prime minister. And then Petro Poroshenko winded up succeeding Yanukovych, having also have served in Yanukovych's regime. And so they basically ensured that these same practices continued. And I'll just note as an important aside is that it's not just corruption at the top. It's part of a whole system that goes all the way down to ordinary people, just expecting that this is just the way things happen in Ukraine, is to pay a bribe, go through a connection to get something. Everybody else is doing it. So if you don't do it, then you're the sucker, or maybe even more so, you're the one that is not fulfilling their duty to their loved ones or their family by taking advantage of the opportunities that you have. And so this is what the oligarchs play on, and that's kind of key to their power. And the demand, by the time that disappointment started to emerge in the Euromaidan, for a new type of politics was just immense. But there weren't any obvious alternatives at the time. So 2015, 2016, there were a lot of discussions about, well, we need some kind of new political face, some kind of new force. But the oligarchs would also harness that by trying to create their own parties that would really be a vehicle for their interests that had new faces. And they would even call themselves Party of New People or New Faces. So it was a very difficult time, but this is what we argue set the stage for Zelensky's rise.
Did you know that wherever you are in the world, you can stream live Intelligence Squared debates and discussions? We've just launched a new online streaming service called Intelligence Squared Plus, where you can tune in to all our upcoming events, ask your questions, vote on motions, and also watch back all our previous events on demand wherever you want. The usual price is $14.99 a month, but for you, our podcast listeners, for just 10 days, we've got a special introductory offer of £10 per month. Visit intelligencesquaredplus.com. or click the link in our description and use the code MONTH10 or ANNUAL10 to start watching. Offer ends at midnight GMT on Tuesday, 20th of December, so subscribe today and don't miss out.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
All right, well, Zelensky's moment seems to be drawing near. So we have this kind of generation of kind of compromised oligarchic political leaders. We have Zelensky's burgeoning media empire as he's using kind of biting satire to plug into kind of public disappointment, dissidence and cynicism. Olga, take us from servant of the people through to his presidential campaign. How did he finally then, after so many years of actually wanting nothing to do with politics, how did he finally step in and run?
I don't know if I'm convinced that he wanted nothing to do with politics. I mean, as Henry already said, being the general producer of Inter makes you quite involved in politics in some way. But, you know, everything that Henry just said, what happens in 2015 is that Ukraine sees yet another major, major spike of poverty. So poverty rates go through the roof in Ukraine. This is also 1 year into the Donbass war with Russia. There's instability in the country. And we're back for some people, for some ordinary citizens. We are back to the place where some people found themselves in the 1990s, not being able to afford to buy meat for dinner. That's actually something that Zelensky talked about as a childhood memory, and his father promising that his friends would have always the ability to eat meat at their home. These are the kind of questions that ordinary Ukrainians were going through, whilst also engaged in a war. And again, with having the sense of disappointment for some following a revolutionary moment. And all of these things are captured in this show, Servant of the People, where Zelensky stars as Vasil Holobrodko, who is a history teacher turned unexpectedly president. After his students submit a video that goes viral and ordinary citizens provide money for this character to be able to pay the amount to become a candidate for president. And the whole entire series of Servant of the People is actually just this real story of ordinary Ukrainians' lives. The fact that ordinary Ukrainians have to pay bribes to get basic things done, that they have to take out credits to buy very simple items for the home, like a microwave, that the oligarchs are controlling political power. All of this is displayed very humorously, and not always my sense of humor, but nonetheless, a little slapstick comedy in those first two seasons. Very clearly. So most ordinary citizens watching that Servant of the People will have recognized that this is art imitating life. This is the experience of ordinary citizens. But then there comes that third season. Zelensky, there's a lot of rumors whether or not Zelensky will run for president in those few years, right? And there's the rumor mill was spinning and spinning. He announces, of course, his presidency in a New Year's Eve address, where he goes from playing a child in a snowsuit to now Vladimir Zelensky, which is the last time I think he calls himself that publicly, which is the Russian way of saying his name, and then goes on to announce his candidacy for president. Then comes the third season of Servant of the People. And the only way to understand that third season is as part of Zelensky's campaign, quite frankly. This is very much the substance of his campaign. It is running during the electoral campaign, so immediately following that January 1st announcement. And it is about a country at war. It is about a country divided. It is about a country that is divided along various different lines that he then shows are not the things that are important to ordinary citizens to Ukrainians, right? And the whole season is about him piecing the country back together in through whatever means he can, ending in a very beautiful few scenes where Donetsk-based miners come to the rescue. The eastern Donetsk-based miners come to the rescue of the western Lviv miners who are stuck underground. And in the very end, in order to pay off Ukraine's mounting IMF debt, Vasilho Borodko makes this beautiful speech on how we need to do this ourselves. And overnight, ordinary citizens of Ukraine in the show collect all of their wealth, belongings, watches, jewelry, money, and place it on the Independence Square, the Maidan, the location where all these mass mobilizations happened before. We call this in the book a virtual incumbency, because the reality is that whilst political science thinks that incumbents have this benefit of their, just because they're there, just because they're present and doing their job and people see them doing their job, they have this incumbency advantage. Whereas Zelensky, he was playing a fictional president on television, but he was in fact doing his job. And he perhaps was seen on television by more ordinary Ukrainians than the actual president was seen on television doing his job. And so we think he benefited from this very real virtual incumbency effect in those few months of the last season of Servant of the People.
Thank you, Olga. And of course, that propels him into the presidency itself. Now, I'm going to take some questions from the audience, because I think they are going to be able to carry us through to the end of the chronology and to the present day. Everyone, thank you for your questions so far. Please do type them in as we go now over the kind of second half of our discussion. But I'm going to go to Raoul first and Henry to you. Was Zelensky popular before the war? So what was the early pre-invasion part of his presidency like? And actually, I'll add to that. What did he come in seeking to do? What was his agenda?
Well, his popularity had ups and downs, but certainly as a performer before he became president, he was tremendously popular. And this is what led to many people actually trying to recruit him into politics, which happened at least a couple of times we documented in the book prior to his actual decision to run at the end of 2018 for the presidency in 2019. And when he won, his victory was the largest in Ukrainian history. I mean, he just trounced the incumbent president, Petro Poroshenko. And so this was the largest margin of victory in Ukrainian history. So he was well over two-thirds approval ratings for the first part of his presidency. But one of the problems that he faced was that just several months into his presidency, less than a year, you had the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, which started to take its toll over time. And of course, you had the ongoing war with Russia. So his popularity began to dip. And it dipped down to maybe about a third of the population approving of his performance, depending on which polls you look. So that was basically the floor for him. And that was right before the February 24th all-out assault by the Russians. What we do note in the book, though, is that still this was higher. His floor was higher than pretty much had been the case for any of his predecessors. The norm in Ukraine had been to come to power on an election, and then the glow would fade, and then they wouldn't even be reelected if you actually had a free election. But in Zelensky's case, he was actually faring better. But then, of course, once the war came, his rating shot back through the roof. So he went through approval ratings of, 30-35%, all the way up to, by some polls, 90% approval ratings. And one thing we do talk about in the book, I'll just mention, is that we argue that 90% has to be interpreted with at least a little grain of salt. And we think what that reflects is primarily just massive agreement that we need to back Zelensky now among Ukrainians, right? Agreeing that they need to back Zelensky now to fight off the Russian massive aggression. But that doesn't mean that they don't harbor doubts underneath. And some people will say openly that, okay, well, we support him now, but we're a democracy. And we have a lot of things that we're going to need to discuss after the election. And so we estimate that a little over a quarter of the population feels that way. So out of that 90% ballpark, about 25-30% have these reservations. But that still leaves three-fifths of the population that really fully and wholeheartedly support him now.
And what was his overall, so his overall program? I mean, we've spoken a lot about patronal politics. I mean, did he come in explicitly to try and clean that up? I mean, was he kind of an anti-corruption candidate, Olga, or was he really talking about aligning Ukraine with Europe? Was it about pushing Russia out of the East? You know, what were his kind of mainstay of ambitions as a new president?
Yeah, certainly. I guess he can be described as an anti-patronal politics candidate. Certainly, he promised to get rid of deputy immunity, which his party did do. He talked about land reform, which they did manage to pass. He also talked about the de-oligarchization of the country, which he is in the process of doing, albeit not without criticism. At the same time, I think, and notably, he was definitely a pro EU candidate. And the pro-European message is not only present in his campaign speeches and then later his speeches as president, but also very much so in the comedy Servant of the People and then in his theatrical performances before. But where perhaps there was not as much clarity on his position on the war with Russia, because he kept saying that peace, he's a peace president. He was a president that kept saying we need peace, perhaps saying that we just need to talk to Russia, we can have negotiations with Russia. And Henry and I write in the book that we think his stance on the war in Donbass and possible negotiations with Russia on Minsk were a little bit naive. They certainly changed very quickly. This was at least how he presented himself during the campaign. Within that first year, it became very clear that this is just, you cannot simply talk with Russia. This is not going to work.
Mm. Thank you, Olga. And sticking with you, let's bring ourselves now up to that fateful day, February 24th, of the first day of the all-out invasion of Ukraine. This is from Francesca, this question. Do you believe a different leader of Ukraine would have fled to the West when Russia invaded?
Well, do I personally believe, or do I as an academic believe? Coulda, woulda, shoulda, we don't know what would have happened. Yanukovych did flee the country. So definitely you have an answer there. Perhaps would others, I can't say. But we do know that he talked to people within his administration in the days prior. Some of the folks that we spoke to, off the record, of course, in those conversations that they had in that week, 2 weeks prior, they said, well, what do we do? And he said, well, you go home, you take your families, you take care of yourself, you leave if you need be, but I'm staying. So that was a message that at least his inner circle knew very clearly.
Thanks, Olga. And just you, just parking the academic kind of need for evidence for 1 second. Like, what's your feeling? You know, you spent so much time, thinking about and listening to and reading the previous leaders of Ukraine. Do you think a Poroshenko or a Timoshenko would have stayed? You know, was this something out of the ordinary, do you think, for a Ukrainian leader to have dug in Kyiv? Certainly, you know, as he was the target of the kind of strategic attempt by Russia to decapitate the regime.
They both stayed as well, and they're doing their duty and they are playing their role in trying to defend Ukraine. I really don't think it's helpful to make Zelensky into this really, truly incredible. It is incredible. He is an incredible figure, but I don't think he's that extraordinary. And actually, our colleague who we cite in the book, Professor Harang, says Zelensky was doing what any good, ordinary Ukrainian would do, play their role in defending the country. And I think that is really what we know about Zelensky. He embodies that civic spirit of ordinary Ukrainians that all of you have seen on your smartphones, on your television screens, where elderly people are trying to stop tanks with their hands, where farmers are trying to take tanks out of the fields. There is this real incredible resilience and bravery amongst ordinary Ukrainians. And I think Zelensky is just like that.
Mm. Well, Henry, so let's disentangle this a little. We've spoken a lot about how Ukraine has shaped Zelensky. Let's talk a little bit about what impacts he himself has either had or not had then on Ukrainian resistance. So I think probably the most visible bit of all of that we would have seen here from the UK, and I imagine many of the people listening to this would have been his speeches that he's given, you know, kind of daily throughout the war. How important are they? Kind of what effect have they had? Let's go on the domestic audience first, and then Olga, I'll turn to you to talk perhaps a little bit about the kind of international aspect of those two.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we argue in the book generally is that his impact in part of the Zelensky effect is that he reflects and amplifies this sense of civic duty and civic national identity, kind of identification and loyalty to a Ukraine for all of its people, all of its citizens. And so he reflects this and amplifies that. And that comes across first and foremost in his speeches. So while we think it's true that lots of ordinary Ukrainians, had they been suddenly thrust into his position of leadership, would have done what he did and stayed, not all of them would have had his skills at communication. And we spend a lot of time in the book talking about his speeches, analyzing them statistically in some cases, but also just presenting the text of some of his words at length, because we think they are very, very important. And he is able to articulate this vision of a united, free, democratic Ukraine in a way that resonates with so many people. And again, even his political opponents have been willing, at least for now, to set aside their political opposition in order to fight for him. So what we don't argue is that he created this sense of civic identity through his words, but he's clearly very effective at articulating them and reminding people why they need to stand up and fight and do their, or support the fight and do their duty before ordinary Ukrainians.
Olga, we've seen him addressing parliaments. We've seen him evoking the kind of national symbols and histories of countries all over the world. I mean, he's been unbelievably good, hasn't he, at convincing nations all over the world that this conflict is involving them as well. And that there are matters at stake here that are far broader than simply Ukraine's territory, but actually the very ideas of democracy in Europe are at stake. Like, was that part of the Zelensky effect, do you think? Was that something that was specifically his ability to do rather than a Poroshenko?
Well, certainly. I think Zelensky is able to communicate in a way that not everyone can. He co-writes his speeches. He has a team helping him out, obviously, as well. But he is able to both write and deliver a really impactful and, quite frankly, beautiful speech. And when he addresses you, he knows how to place the emphasis on the right words in the right moments, taking the pauses where necessary. So I think that's clear, right? And certainly his career as an actor and on stage and theater has helped. But he also has this capacity to understand which pieces of information, some of that you just identified, are the ones that need to be deployed because they will land particularly well with a given audience. And of course, he was able to do that with audiences around the world in a way that I think few, quite frankly, politicians globally can. But also, I saw him speaking to our students in the United Kingdom, Ukrainian students and others around the United Kingdom. And he did this, obviously, through a video address. And he was able to speak to them, not only as this wartime president and international figure, but in a way that resonated with them, right? Talking about the sorts of things that are important to them in their daily lives. He was able to connect to them on a very personal level, even though he was doing it on a screen from, many, many miles away. And I think that's exactly this. He reads his audiences very well. He knows exactly which these nuggets to use in his speeches. And he does so also for the Ukrainian audiences. One of the things that we did in the book is we took this one poem by Lina Kostenko, Treba думати мізерно, You Don't Have to Think Meagerly, that he used in a particular wartime speech. And Lina Kostenko is a very famous poetess and dissident from the 1960s. She is adored and beloved by many, many Ukrainians. So much so that her poems are graffiti on walls in Kyiv and Lviv and Kharkiv. Youth love Lina Kostenko. And he was able to very cleverly interject this poem. There's no need to think meagerly. When he was talking about those politicians in Ukraine that were calling to give up or to succumb to Russia's aggression, right? And he was naming them, calling them out, interrupts that, and says this poem. And he does it in a way that everyone just gets chills when they hear it, right? To a different audience, it's probably not poetess Lina Kostenko, but nonetheless, he knows exactly what to use at which moment.
Yeah, that really is a beautiful, beautiful example. Sorry, Henrietta. Go ahead.
Yeah, can I just add one more thing? I think that we would both emphasize is that his speaking ability isn't just about the ability to sort of reel out a stemwinder, right? To really rile people up and connect with them in these flowery long speeches, which he can do. But he's also very adept at social media, which was an essential part of his appeal, back before his presidential campaign, but certainly during his presidential campaign. So many of his appeals are very short, right? They're just a minute, Instagram, Facebook, something like that. And those often have a huge reach across the world, as well as in Ukraine, and can make very targeted points. And he's just very good at making them almost off the cuff. In some cases, we've been told they actually are more or less just off the cuff, but very to the point and very effective.
Thanks. And Henry, let's stay with you. This next question is from Michael. Michael, thank you for your question. And it begins to move us towards the future now. So Michael asks, do you think Zelensky is a pragmatist? Would he sign a deal with Russia to end the war?
Well, I think the question is under what circumstances. I think he would happily sign a deal with Russia to end the war if Ukraine got all of its territory back, Russia receded to its own borders, Russia paid Ukraine compensation, reparations of some kind, right? So I think he would clearly accept that. I guess I would be very surprised if he would accept almost anything short of that. Certainly anything ceding Ukrainian territory, letting Russia get any actual territorial gain from this. At this point, I can't imagine him accepting that. Beyond that, it becomes negotiations over when sanctions might be lifted on Russia, what kind of reparations, how much reparations should be paid, and whether and how war crimes should be prosecuted involving Russians, and when it comes time to sign a deal along those lines. I'm sure he'd be happy to end the war. But at this point, I just find it almost impossible to believe that he would sign something, that most Ukrainians would find to be a premature settlement, especially given the success of the Ukrainians on the battlefield, which has just validated, his whole stance, which is rolling back Russian aggression. It's very slow. It's very painful, but it is happening.
Olga, this is such an important question. I'd like to go to you on the same one, because in a way, like it seems, at least to me, on the one hand, with Putin's kind of autocratic power and now Zelensky's kind of wild popularity and kind of symbolic representation of Ukrainian nationhood, you have two, it almost feels like it's reduced now, the end of the war, to these two personalities and what they each decide to do and what they each decide to try and corral their nation into. Is that right? And if it is the case, really what kind of a leader are we going to see in Zelensky as he comes ultimately to that negotiating table? Do you agree with Henry, really? It's going to be, it is this red line around full restoration of Ukrainian territorial integrity and nothing less than that.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. Here I'm going to cite the title of our colleague's book, Sam and Graham, Graham Robertson and Sam Green. Their book title is Putin v. the People. Now, I think that's very much the kind of scenario that we do have in Putin. Whereas Zelensky, as we keep saying in the book, is a product of his nation, is the embodiment of the median voter in Ukraine. He is with the people and they are with him because he is embodying their central aims, goals, and views on things. Right now, according to surveys that we've been running this year with Henry, we know that the population is not supportive of negotiations, certainly when it means losing territory, right? We've asked this question more than once, and we know that there is no appetite for this sort of negotiation. So if Zelensky were to negotiate away some territory or accept that some territory is now remaining in the hands of Russian control, quite frankly, he would lose the people. Very simply. This is not an autocracy. This, you know, still is a wartime democracy with all its issues, right? And there's a lot of centralization of power happening and a lot of criticism of that in the media sphere, for instance. But Zelensky will need his people. And if he goes against them, they will vote him out, I think. That's very clear right now. So I think it's a little bit trickier. And we talk about this also in the book. We conducted a list experiment to figure out what is the true voting intention support for Zelensky. And we do find that there is about 25 or so plus percent of the population that declare that they would vote in an outright question, that say, yes, we would vote for Zelensky. But then when you ask them in a manner that hides them in some way, I guess, disguises them from the interviewer, then they in fact say, no, we would vote for somebody else, or we would not vote for Zelensky in this case. So his critics and opponents have not gone away. He has high support, but he knows it is not, in fact, in the 90s, as Henry already said. And Zelensky is made by the people instead of being against the people, as Putin might be. So he will need them, and he will need to pay attention and listen to them and what they want in this war.
Well, we're almost at time, but I think we have just about enough to crowbar one last question in. It's a wonderful one. So I've been hoping we can ask this. Henry, over to you for the final one. So how will Zelensky be remembered? And this is an audience question, thank you, anonymously written. How will Zelensky be remembered in history, or by history? I mean, is it inevitable now that he's going to join the kind of pantheon of kind of great world leaders, you know, up there with Mandela and Gandhi and Churchill and so on?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable. We have to see what the war brings. It's just impossible to tell the future. The war could end in many different ways. If we had to go by today's trajectory, though, I think for sure he would be remembered as a great wartime leader. Then there will be debates on his presidency before that point, whether or not his wartime leadership reflected a new Zelensky, which is an argument some have made, although we've argued that, in fact, it's the same old Zelensky, who actually accomplished a good amount relative to others under very difficult circumstances in Ukraine. So probably that would be how he'd be remembered. But again, there's so much ahead that it's just too hard to predict. Some debacle happens, who knows? But at least I think the current trajectory is good. And the biggest, you know, questions lying ahead, I think, if Ukraine wins the war, a kind of a clear victory, then, questions will be more about, well, what is Zelensky going to do with all of this popularity that he has?
All right. Well, on that itself, a great question. Let's end it. Olga, Henry, thank you. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. The book, I have it right here, is The Zelensky Effect. I heartily recommend it. It's a really, really wonderful insight into clearly such an important person for us all to understand. I'm Carmilla, and you've been watching or listening to Intelligence Squared. Thanks so much for coming, everyone. Thanks for your wonderful questions, and hope to see you again soon. Thanks very much. Goodbye.